welcome back. It's so lovely to see so many of you guys today. We're really excited that you're all going to be involved in this project all year. For those that I didn't meet last time, I'm Shanaz. I'll be spending time with you all individually, hopefully, and as groups over the next course of this year. And we'll be talking about the Cradle Hangover Project in detail later on today. So we're going to hand you over to Professor Matthew Watson in a bit. After this, you're going to go straight into breakout sessions, where they're going to give you a research skills session at 12 o'clock, and then there'll be food, because I'm not going to starve you all day. And then this afternoon, you're going to get a chance to start exploring your projects and talking to ambassadors a bit more. And then we will end with a panel discussion with two academics from PACE and sociology. So it's really about, the afternoon's really about interactive and start exploring your ideas about the themes that you explored this morning. I know it's running a bit late, and if anybody does want any coffee or tea, we will get that to you during the lectures as well. But I'm going to just hand over and go find my last school. So brilliant.
Thanks very much, Shanaz. Hello, everyone. My name is Matthew Watson. Most people call me Matt, apart from my mum, who always calls me Matthew, especially when I'm in trouble. And being 47 doesn't make it any less likely that you're going to get in trouble with your mum. So you've got that to look forward to when you get to my age. It's all been a bit hectic so far this morning. I was meant to have until 11 o'clock to talk to you. It might be that I can sneak an extra 5 minutes on top of that, but I'm going to have to maybe narrow down the scope of what I was going to say to you, which the good news for you is that means that I'll have to cut out all of my prepared jokes and just focus on the content of what I'm going to say. And if you've ever had to sit there and listen to a middle-aged man tell jokes for half an hour, you'll realise that actually being late was a very good thing for you. Welcome to the University of Warwick, welcome to the Department of Politics and International Studies, welcome in particular to our project on the colonial hangover. What we're seeking to do within this project is to explore the ways in which the legacies of empire still have an effect on how we live our lives today. And what we really, really, really want to explore is how they leave legacies that still impact upon people at a personal level. At one level, we might think that the British Empire is the thing of the past. It was formally disbanded in the post-Second World War period. It's understood to be an historical relic of a Britain that doesn't exist anymore. But you would be amazed at just how many images of empire confront you every day. What you'll also be amazed about is how often you don't spot them for what they are. It's as if you have to look with a different pair of eyes to make sure that those images are decoded in a way that makes you certain that what you're looking at is a country that has formally lost its empire, that formally now denounces lots of aspects of empire, but within which images of empire and the privileges associated with being an imperial nation still affect public life in some very, very important ways. If any of you can cast your mind back to the EU referendum campaign, every time that clown Boris Johnson opened his mouth and said anything, he was talking to you about some fantastical land emerging out of the past that was there for Britain to seize again in the context of Brexit. It was an imperial vision of Britain as a global power and Britain as a global actor that was able to impose their interests on the rest of the world. If you watch things like The Apprentice, I believe there was a bit of a scandal just before Christmas when one of the tasks they were set involved, was it gin making or something? Or one of the groups started to make gin and called it a name that had an imperial resonance without any reflection on that at all. Whether that was appropriate, whether that was something that reflected well upon them, or whether they were appropriating a cultural history which is controversial still today. So one of the things that I hope you're going to be able to do over the course of the next year is to begin to reflect more about various images of empire. Sorry that the slides are quite so small. You're all young, so I'm sure you've got very good eyesight, much better than mine. I'm a bit technologically ineffective, and this is as big as I can get the slides to look. It might be that there's a button somewhere around here that would make it go all the way across the board behind me, but I'm a bit scared of computers, every time I see a button, I think I'm going to break something if I press it. So can you put up with it just looking like that? So these are potential images of empire, aren't they? But these are very explicit. These carry very clearly a particular connotation of a particular time in British history when Britain had a number of imperial possessions. Possessions meaning other countries that it had decided to settle and rule over. But images of empire are not often this explicit. Let me give you a little anecdote. One year I was teaching a bunch of third year undergraduates and we were starting to unpack issues of empire and the legacies that they continue to have in the structure of the global economy. And I set them a task. Think of it as homework, if you will. I told them to go out, take any particular day, presumably it had to be a weekend because they would have less to do on the weekend, before the next class, and to go and count the number of cues that they received in one way or another that were a reminder of Britain's imperial past and Britain's imperial legacy. And they looked a bit confused about what I was asking them to do, and I had to explain that I thought they might be in for a surprise. But that until you begin to look for those cues, they can pass you by without you recognising them for what they are. But as soon as you begin to look for them, as soon as you switch your eyes on into looking for them and trying to decode the political messages that are there for you, you can rack up quite a number of hits in terms of how many of these cues that you detect. Try it one day and you'll see, I'm sure, that I'm true. At the very least, my students were exceptionally surprised about how many they got to. These are unscientific findings because I didn't tell them what counted as an image of empire. I just told them to go out and try to look at the world slightly differently and to begin to understand whether those images were there in front of them in an everyday context. So they went out one day and they began to look at buildings. They began to look at their own cities in a very different light. They began to look at people as they walked past them in the street. They began to look at their friends. They began to look at the leisure and the entertainment that they consume in very different ways. Now, some of my students who had the most expansive conception of what would count as these images of empire, they gave up after a couple of hours. They were exhausted. They were already into the many hundreds. And they thought that they can't continue for a whole day counting like this. They're going to have to go and have a lay down and a think about it. Even those that took the strictest definition of only an explicit reminder of empire inscribed somewhere in either the built environment or their everyday relationships would count. They got up to 20, 30, 40 over the course of the day. They were all hugely surprised by this, bar none. Everyone was surprised at how many of these cues there were. And they were surprised in a range of different ways. For some of them, the surprise manifested itself as an amazement that a country that had supposedly left its colonial past behind was still littered with these reminders on a day-to-day basis. For some of them, the surprise struck them as a form of anger at themselves. They were annoyed that all those cues were out there to be read. But until they've been encouraged to actively go out and look with a pair of eyes that would tell them about this, they've gone past them on a day-to-day basis. And some of them, it was just general and genuine bafflement at how all these things are there within the built environment, within their social environment, within their cultural environment, but they'd never thought to look at them in that way before. Now, I did the test myself. After seeing just what an effect it had had upon them, I decided that the next Saturday I would spend a normal day in Birmingham, where I live, and see whether I could count how many of these cues that came to me. And I also had to give up very quickly because I was just overwhelmed by how much it was. One of the differences here is how visible they are, I think. Some of these reminders of empire are etched very visibly into the built environment. But of course, buildings don't speak to us directly. So you do have to go and look for them. Let me give you one or two examples of what I mean by this. Now, there are those of you who will recognise this. This is Birmingham City Hall. And Birmingham City Hall is a magnificent building that you stand in front of it. And I think you can't help but admire the aesthetic of the building itself. You can't help but admire the workmanship as well. In here, and also there, and also there, are friezes made by stonemasons. It's unbelievably intricate design that is carved into stone. But you can also download off the internet guides to what these friezes mean and what they stand for. And for those of you who do live in Birmingham, do this and go and have a look, because you will look at the City Hall in a vastly different way next time. Because all of these friezes depict a relationship between Birmingham, the city, its economy, and the imperial structure in which Birmingham became a great industrial city. So I really would recommend those of you who live in Birmingham to do that. This is a picture that I managed to download. There were people walking in. I wondered what was happening then, of Southampton. Now, I know some of you here are from Southampton. And the docks have changed out of all recognition since the 19th century, often as a legacy of the Second World War, of course. But Southampton prided itself on being the embarkation point for empire, for those people from Britain who were going out to the New World to seek a new life. They would very, very often leave from Southampton. The docks were built around this image of the city as the gateway to empire. So next time you're down in the dock area, have a look round and see what you can find that might still be a reminder of that. We have students from Liverpool as well who will actually be coming tomorrow because they got the wrong day, so we're having to do this twice rather than just once. Draw your own conclusions. But a lot of the public buildings in Liverpool are fascinating because they have this sort of design on there. I hope at the back that you might be able to see these. These are pictures of African children carrying bags of money. These are all allusions to the transatlantic slave trade. That Liverpool was the centre of the British activity within the transatlantic slave trade. Jonathan Tasnima did some research for me on Liverpool showing just how much it was involved, that the money coming into the city that's built a whole range of really glorious public buildings was all based on the trade in humans. And you need to know where to go to look to find these things. And of course, other images of empire have been overridden. This is the famous Lloyd's Building in London. That you're probably aware of is the centre to so much of the global insurance industry. And that building stands on the site in Leadenhall Street of the old East India Company headquarters. So the East India Company, that at one stage both accounted for a third of the British workforce and had a standing army that was larger than the official British army, that had spheres of operations running all the way from the West Indies all the way through to China, that became the company that ran the whole of the South Asian continent as a possession of the corporation itself. Its headquarters are no longer there, but of course that ground is still resonant with the decisions that were made about how to run the British East India Company. So the built environment that we live in, the cities that we live in, that we call home, they are often built on money that was generated through British involvement in the imperial economy. But we have to know where we're looking to be able to render those reminders visible to us. There's another aspect of invisibility as well. The legacy of empire still exists in the psyche of so much of the population of this country. But how do you render that visible? You could just walk down the street and approach random strangers and tap them on the shoulder and say, "Excuse me, mate, give me your opinion on empire." But you probably wouldn't want to do that for all sorts of different reasons. Not only would it make you feel very uncomfortable, I think, you might terrify the person that you've just stopped in the street. So how do we render this visible? Well, one strategy might be to look at polling data. And YouGov, has run some polls in recent years that reveal some, I think, rather surprising results. In 2014, the first time that YouGov ever thought to ask the British population what they thought of empire, they did it through the question of whether empire was something that British people should be proud of, and in particular whether you, as the respondent, are proud of Britain's imperial past and of its imperial legacy. Now, a number of people undernerd and said, "Ooh, I don't know," or "Ooh, I don't really have an opinion on that," as if it's something that you wouldn't have an opinion on. But if we take those out and just look at the people who gave a definitive yes or no, then how many people do you think in 2014 said that the British Empire was something that they were proud of? Have a guess. How big are those numbers, do you think? Anyone? Shout out.
67%.
And have you guessed high because I told you it would be a surprisingly high number?
No, I think I've actually read an article about 44% of people said yes, so I'm trying to round it up.
Yeah, of the people that had a definitive answer to this, it was actually three quarters. 75% of people today in this country think that the British Empire is something to be proud of. That means that when you're walking down the street, random strangers come past you, on average, three out of four of those random strangers will think that the British Empire is something to be proud of. YouGov repeated this in 2016 with a slightly different question. They asked people to say whether they thought the British Empire was a good thing. And about the same results came out. It was about 70% of the definitive answers this time. So again, almost three in four people said that the British Empire was a good thing. More surprisingly still, to my mind, if you disaggregate that polling data either by social class or by region or by age, so including young people, including people of your age, in none of those categories did a majority of people say that the countries that Britain had colonised were worse off for that colonial experience. A majority of people in all of these categories said that those colonised countries were better off for having been run, often quite brutally, and from afar, by a standing British army. So those were the opinion poll data. I personally found this really, really, really surprising that those numbers were very high. It might be a reflection on the fact that I spend my life working in a university environment. Universities are normal in that regard. The sorts of opinions that you find in universities are often less populist, more progressive, more left-wing than opinions that you find within the general population. But still, this came as a real surprise to me that there was this really ingrained ideal that existed in people's minds that wanted to hang on to this legacy of empire, to think that this legacy of empire was something that was intrinsically a good thing. And this seemed to me to be going against the grain of a lot of political developments in recent years. Now, it's certainly not the case by any means that all politicians will offer apologies on behalf of Britain for the atrocities that were conducted under former British imperial rule. But some of them have got very close to doing that. Some of them have even done that. They operate within a sphere where the political liberation campaigns will understand that some of those politicians appear to be on their side. Do you know who this is? Yeah? This is Tony Blair. He was Prime Minister from 1997 to 2007. And in 2006, on the eve of the bicentenary of the passing of the Abolition of the Slave Trade Act in Britain, he made a formal apology on behalf of the British people for Britain's involvement in the transatlantic slave trade. He called it a crime against humanity. An elected politician saying that his predecessors as Prime Minister had overseen a system that legitimated a crime against humanity. Now, it could be, of course, that he genuinely meant this. It could be that at this time he was faced with a newly elected David Cameron as leader of the Conservative Party, And it's probably the case that he already knew by then, although it wasn't common knowledge, that Cameron's family fortune had resulted from the 1807 abolition of the Slave Trade Act, when Cameron's family were one of the few within Britain that were paid huge amounts of compensation for giving up their entitlements to trade in slaves. That's where David Cameron's family got all of his money from. But it might be that it wasn't a cynical political ploy from Blair at all. He might have genuinely meant it. And the words, "I am sorry," carried a lot of meaning, because politicians find it very hard to apologise for anything, as you're probably aware. They certainly find it very hard to apologise for historical events that were no part of their actual decision-making. Contrast this, for instance, with David Cameron. This is a picture taken of him in 2013 when he's laying a wreath on behalf of the British government in Amritsar in India. In 1919 in Amritsar, a general in the British Army ordered his troops to open fire on an unarmed crowd who were protesting against British occupation. Well over 1,000 people were killed in that single moment. Cameron was asked whether he was going to apologise for that, and he said that he was happy to call it a deeply shameful event. He was then asked again, "Okay, but are you going to apologise for that?" And he said that he fitted in this lineage of conservative leaders going all the way back to Winston Churchill that had decried the activities of the British Army personnel on that day. He was asked for a third time, "Okay, Prime Minister, but are you going to apologise for that?" And he said it would be wrong to reach back into history to give apologies on behalf of the nation. It would be wrong to reach back in history. This is the same David Cameron who 3 years earlier gained political plaudits in 2010, when on the publication of the Savile Review of the Bloody Sunday killings in Derry, in Northern Ireland, in 1972, he had formally apologised to those people on behalf of the British nation. They were unarmed protesters in the streets of Derry, and they were protesting against what they saw as British occupation, and they were killed by British Army personnel. He thought that they deserved an apology on behalf of the British nation, but a group of locals in Amritsar in India in 1919, who were also protesting against British occupation, who were also unarmed, who were also shot on by British Army personnel, that they did not deserve that same apology. Isn't that interesting that there are double standards in operation now? Here's William Hague, also in 2013, when he was Foreign Secretary. He told the House of Commons, not in this actual speech, but he told the House of Commons nonetheless, that he had sincere regret at the use of torture and rendition and indiscriminate murder amongst British Army personnel when Britain was vacating Kenya in the 1950s on the eve of Kenyan independence. He was asked whether sincere regret meant an apology, and he referred back to the time 8 months previously when he'd said that Britain had nothing to apologise for in Kenya, and that anyone that thought otherwise, he would happily see them in court. He sort of changed his tune 8 months later, but it's probably noticeable that he made this statement to the House of Commons late at night when there was hardly anyone in the chamber before, when all the reporters had gone home, and I think, probably, because I can't find evidence to the contrary, that the television cameras had been turned off as well. So there are issues, clearly, revolving around the way that British politicians apologise for empire. But if you go back to the public opinion surveys, where 75% of the population seem to think that empire was a good thing, still seem to think that empire was a good thing, this sets those apologies in a different context. It's as if the British public is telling prime ministers like Tony Blair that they have no right to apologise because they don't think that there's anything to apologise for. So public opinion is a very, very fickle master, and it's interestingly arranged in this regard. So my life within a university, however, is rather different to this. We engage with political liberation campaigns on a daily basis, people who think not only that apologies are due for atrocities associated with the running of the British Empire, but also that reparations are due as well. If you forcibly take over a land, and if you forcibly subdue the population, if you prevent it from generating its own indigenous economic capacity, if you run it as a subsidiary to your own country but subjugate it time and time and time again, is there a point at which you have to admit not only that that was wrong, but that you need to pay some degree of compensation? There are a number of important reparation campaigns being run in countries across the former British Empire. At the moment, these have had no effect on British policy. They seem to have had very little effect on British public opinion. But they are the sorts of things that are talked about on an everyday basis on university campuses. So university campuses might be slightly different in this regard. Here's my relationship with some of these political campaigns. One interesting thing that's happened in universities recently is that there's been much more awareness of what is being taught through university degrees, especially degrees in the social sciences, in the arts, and in the humanities. This started off from a small-scale campaign on some campuses, asking the question, maybe just a rhetorical question, but an important question anyway, why isn't my professor black? Looking at the huge imbalance and the huge disproportionate imbalance between numbers in the white population and numbers of the white population who end up in university professorships like me, to a broader campaign looking at the curriculum itself, looking at what university lecturers choose to teach as the basis of their subject field. And this campaign is called Why Is My Curriculum White? And you might have heard something about this just last week because there was an interesting spat that arose over an announcement made by the Students' Union at SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies in the University of London, a college that's set up dedicated specifically to teaching about Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. Now, one of the things they were asking for was some greater reflection on the content of the philosophy syllabus. For a school that is set up specifically to teach about Africa, Asia, and the Middle East, the Students' Union had noticed that there was a distinct absence of philosophers from Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. That they were taught philosophy and the history of philosophy as if it was a solely European affair. And they were asking for more balance in the curriculum. Not to say we're not going to learn about any European philosophers over the last 2,500 years at all, thank you very much, we don't want that. But please can we have this balanced in a way that seems to fit the mission statement of the School of Oriental and African Studies rather more. In leaks the Daily Mail, guess what? They weren't impressed with this one jot. You won't be able to see this, but the important line in the Daily Mail report is down right at the bottom there. In fact, I can hardly see it from here, so you're not going to see it from there. They said the students were objecting to the curriculum and were asking for important philosophers to be dropped from it. Here's the key five words: simply because they are white. Not a bit of it. They were asking for balance and reflection on the content of the curriculum. They might have asked that in a slightly clumsy manner, but nonetheless, it's an important challenge. And it's an important challenge that people at universities are now facing on a day-to-day basis. And we're facing that because we have a great latitude that your teachers don't have. We're able to negotiate the content of our courses with our students on an ongoing basis. We're able to reflect on the sorts of learning objectives that our own students have, and we're able to align the things that we teach them, the content that we teach them, to that. So there's always this constant back and to between us and our students. Your teachers, unfortunately for them, are placed in a rather different position. They are handed a national curriculum that they know that you will be examined on at the end of your A-levels. And the pressure is therefore upon them to teach you the things that you will be examined on. There are good reasons for this, the good reasons that exist beyond the damned league table society. Good reasons that relate to your aspirations to maybe go on into higher education and take up a university place, which is dependent on you doing well in your A-levels. But your teachers don't have the sort of latitude to respond to issues about the curriculum as I do, for instance. And one of my former PhD students has a wonderful story to tell in this regard. I haven't been able to speak to him this week, so I better not say who he is because I don't have his permission to tell the story. So I'll tell it in the third person rather than to name him. He remembers having a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful history teacher for his A-levels. An old school teacher that didn't really take any notice of the curriculum. That he allowed them to constantly confront the knowledge that was embedded in their textbooks by teaching them a very different version of British history. He treated them as if they were not sitting for an exam, but that they were there to be moulded as informed citizens and informed global citizens. And he had an absolutely terrific time, couldn't speak more highly of this teacher, but he only became aware of what the potential downside to this teaching strategy was when he was sitting in his A-level exam. He turned his examination paper over and he realised for the first time that the curriculum does mean something, because the curriculum is what you're examined on, and what he'd been taught for the last 2 years didn't appear anywhere on his examination paper. He had to do his A-levels again before he was able to come to university. The whole year had to do their history A-level again because every single one of them failed it. So the curriculum does mean something. The curriculum acts as some sort of constraint that is on your teacher. So who is responsible for putting the national curriculum in place? Well, it comes through the Department of Education, and the person formally responsible is the Secretary of State for Education. So at the moment is, anyone know?
Justine de Greening.
Who said that?
Me.
Well done. The Right Honourable Justine Greening, no less. But it wasn't her that put in place the most important bits of the national curriculum when looking at this from a perspective of the colonial hangover. That person is Michael Gove. Do you remember Michael Gove? He's been in the news this week looking like a complete idiot falling off the Trump. He was the first British journalist that was able to interview Trump since Trump had won the election. You know, what can you say? He was also the person that engaged in a new form of politics in the referendum campaign that's now known as post-truth politics. That it doesn't matter if what you say is actually backed by any factual evidence, but as long as you can say it in a way that convinces people that they have those experiences of the world, that's all right. So here he is being presented with some of his post-factual claims in the EU referendum campaign. And he's also known, of course, as the person that managed to stab Boris Johnson's in the back, and also managed to do so in such a ham-fisted way that, as the cartoon shows, he stabbed himself in the front at the same time. But he's the person that was responsible for the national curriculum in the way and the content that it takes at the moment. So he set the broad boundaries in which a number of civil servants then had to flesh that out in a number of topics. He had a particular view of the history and politics national curriculums that took place around what he called our iron story. A story of how plucky little Britons had managed to create their own empire, had managed to subject a third of the world's population and to rule over the biggest empire that the world had ever seen. He was dismissive of lots of academics who are now deeply, deeply critical of the imperial mission. He thought that this was negativity, that this was talking Britain down, that there was a glorious past to be recovered that could lead to an equally glorious future, and damn those academics who tore Britain down. But those academics spoke back. Academics from the Royal Historical Society, in particular, pointed out that there's nothing new about the phrase "our island story." There was a book published by Henrietta Elizabeth Marshall in 1905 called exactly the same thing. And look what it's called at the top, A History of England for Boys and Girls. But not for any old boys and girls, but for boys and girls who could be expected to become the next administrators of empire. Note the date, 1905. This was almost like a conduct book. A conduct book that would teach people how to become the next generation that will go out into the world and upkeep the traditions of the British Empire. And this is exactly the same imagery that Michael Gove was seeking to instill. So there we have it, I think I've got about 5 minutes left. Is that right, James?
Yes, it's 11:09.
I've got 5 minutes left. So then we have it, two sources in which the legacies of empire are still very, very much apparent. One is in public opinion, which we don't really get a glimpse of unless somebody starts shouting their opinion at us in the street. And the sorts of people that shout at you in the street, they're the sorts of people that you're probably least likely to stop and listen to. They're the people to be shuffled past quickly on the other side, aren't they? Slightly more visible is the terms of the national curriculum. And one of the things that Shanaz is going to talk to you about our project is the possibility of capturing the colonial handover in some sort of artwork. Wasn't last week a young woman who just got a rejection letter from the University of Oxford? Was she called Claudia Fulliani? And she turned it into a piece of abstract artwork by cutting pieces out of it, all of the key lines of, "No, we're not having you, go away, go to a different university." Okay, they didn't say quite like that, but you know what I mean. And she turned it into this abstract artwork that became a viral sensation. Look for it on the internet, it's very interesting. Maybe, as one instance, you could do the same with the national curriculum to see what that would do to it. David Bowie, I believe, had an approach to writing his lyrics called the cut-up approach, that he would take blocks of text and he would cut all the words out individually, put them into a bag and just put his hand in and take them out at random, happy that what would emerge would be nonsensical in any sort of prose terms. Try doing that with the national curriculum and what it says on our part. That's nonsense meets nonsense in probably a very artistic way. But there are other forms of much more visible imagery of the empire. Lots of the statues that are around in marketplaces everywhere have colonial heroes on top of them. For those of you from London, there is nothing more typical, I think, of the postcard images of London than all of the statues that are just everywhere. But go and have a look at the people that are on the statues. You've never heard of them. Then go and Google it. See why they're famous. See why they're there. See what connection that they have to empire. On this picture, there is actually me, but I don't think you can see it. I'm down there with a hat on and a beard. This is me in Shrewsbury, in the market square in Shrewsbury. And I'm standing in front of a statue of Robert Clive. Robert Clive is usually known as Clive of India. Clive of India was the man who rose from a junior accounts clerk in the British East India Company to a mercenary soldier who led the British East India Company army for personal financial gain. And he did so very successfully, to the point at which he became the ruler of the whole of South Asia. This is a famous painting, and another way in which legacies of empire are made visible to you. Check out the art galleries in the cities in which you live. Go and have a look at some of the portraiture to see how colonial heroes are immortalised in paint. This is a painting by Francis Hamer, who apparently was one of the founder members of the Royal Academy, the most famous association for artists in this country. And if he was one of the founder members, presumably he's Sir Francis Hamer. This is a picture of Clive. This is meant to be a depiction of Clive who I think is a desperate war criminal. But look, he's put in fancy clothes, looking very statesmanlike, receiving homage from the Mir Jaffer, the first Nawab of Bengal, under protection of the British East India Army. And here's a picture of the army. Now, it's a little consolation to me now, with my views on empire today, that Clive came back to this country, and apparently, according to his biographers, he was really dissatisfied about the fact that he wasn't treated in such heroic terms as, say, Nelson or Wellington. And the people sort of left him on his own. They thought he was a grubby mercenary. But what about the me that was your age? What did Robert Clive mean to me when I was your age? Well, this is where I was when I was your age. I was at Sir John Talbot's Comprehensive School in Whitchurch in Shropshire. And Clive had a particular meaning to me because one of the houses of my school was named after him. They tried to name the houses, the three houses, after three North Shropshire heroes. One of which, the yellow house that I was in, was called Bridgewater, named after the Duke of Bridgewater, who was a Victorian philanthropist who helped to build loads of canals. The orange house was Darwin, named after Charles Darwin, who went to school in Shrewsbury, had no actual connection with Shropshire, but he was claimed as one of their own because there aren't many famous people from North Shropshire. The third one was probably the actual only famous person from North Shropshire, Robert Clive. Robert Clive. I went to an almost entirely white school. There was one family of South Asians that went to my school, and they were both in Clive House. And it's an element of regret to me that I never had the foresight to ask them at that stage what that meant to them, or whether that was just treated as so normal that they didn't think to question it either. I have to say that my school doesn't have the names of those houses anymore. The houses of my school are now named after North Shropshire beauty spots. And I want to go back to my old school and ask the question of why. Why was it changed? Was it because of the recognition that it was no longer acceptable, if it ever was, to have Clive as the name of one of the houses? But this is the way that often people are honoured, isn't it? They name houses at schools after them. But it's not just my school. What happens, for so many of you out there, if you go to a school or a college where the whole name of the school invokes an imperial legacy? Because presumably you know that Joseph Chamberlain spent 8 years between 1895 and 1903 as the Marquess of Salisbury's colonial Secretary of State for the colonies. He ran the colonial office. He was given the pick of all of the top jobs in government. Salisbury assumed that he would take either the chancellorship so that he could run the nation's finances, or he would become the Home Secretary. But no, he said, I can do much more for my party, for my city, and for my people, to be the colonial secretary. And his view of the colonies were that they were simply there as an economic possession to extract as much economic value out of it as possible. So what does it mean to go to a school that's named after someone like this? That's very interesting, isn't it? I'm not suggesting that you go and tear the signs down tomorrow morning. Please don't do that, because you'll get in trouble, I'll get in trouble. And I'm going to blame it on your three teachers, so they'll get in trouble as well. But it makes you think, doesn't it, that so many of these everyday activities, so many of the things we do just normally on a day-to-day basis, so many of the links that we have with our own cities, our own towns, our places of birth, the schools that we went to, the colleges that we go to, the leisure that we undertake, the TV programs we watch, the games we play on our computers, so much of this has some sort of link to the legacy of Britain as a colonial power. These are the sorts of things that I want you to think about over the course of the time that you spend with us this year. And hopefully these are things that you might be able to capture, whether that's in an essay or within a piece of artwork, the competitions that we'll be running that Shanaz will talk to you about later. as the day progresses. I think, because Jonas keeps looking at his watch, I think he's telling me that I've probably spoken for long enough and that he and the other ambassadors will need to get you to the breakout sessions that you're going to now. It's all been a bit hectic because of our late start. I hope that's given you things to think about. I'll be around for the rest of the day, so you can always ask me questions if you do have any questions on anything I've said. Thank you very much for your time and for listening.